Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
In 1999, Patrick Duane Murphy, a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation, or MCN, attacked another member of the tribe on the MCN reservation in Oklahoma. Murphy stabbed and cut the other man, causing severe wounds. The man later died. A state court found Murphy guilty of murder and sentenced him to death in 2000. Since then, he has attempted to appeal the ruling. He claims that because the crime took place on Indian land and the victim was Native American, the state of Oklahoma did not have the right to try him. In the United States, the federal government has legal jurisdiction over murders carried out by Native Americans on lands in Indian country. The term Indian country means land inside federally recognized reservation borders. Dependent Indian communities, or areas historically given to tribe members which their families still hold. In time, Murphy's case landed in a federal appeals court. After examining historic documents and earlier rulings, judges overturned the guilty finding in August 2017. This meant that Murphy could have a new trial in a federal court, with the tribal court sharing jurisdiction. In federal court, he would likely escape execution because federal law gives tribes the right to decide if they want to execute criminals. MCN rejected the death penalty. But that was not the end of the case. In fact, it became stranger. The MCN reservation covers nearly 2 million hectares of land and 11 Oklahoma counties, with a total population of about 950,000. Recognizing MCN's jurisdiction meant all this land was legally Indian country. And that, in turn, meant that MCN had civil and criminal jurisdiction over nearly half the state of Oklahoma. Oklahoma has taken the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. The state argues that MCN stopped existing in 1907 when Congress created the state. MCN says the land is theirs, as established by an 1866 treaty. But there is a problem with Oklahoma's argument. The law says only Congress has the power to change reservations, and it must do so in very clear language. And in the case of the state of Oklahoma, Congress never did it. Now the Supreme Court will decide. In arguments at the court on November 27th, Oklahoma's lawyers said if the federal decision that overturned Murphy's sentence is accepted, the results would be like an earthquake. tribe members would not have to pay state taxes and could demand tax money from non-Native business owners. MCN could also write its own land use and environmental laws. Oklahoma also worries that hundreds of jailed Native Americans who were tried in the state system would have to be retried in federal courts. Oklahoma is one of the nation's biggest producers of oil and natural gas, and the energy industry is worried about the case. The Oklahoma Independent Petroleum Association prepared a friend of the court briefing. It noted that if the federal decision is not overturned, the tribe could rightly take possession of oil and natural gas wells that sit on its land. Robert Miller says the association's concerns are exaggerated. Miller is a member of the Eastern Shawnee Tribe in Oklahoma and a professor at Arizona State University's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. The struggle between governments is over money and power, and power means jurisdiction, he said. Oklahoma can still control its non-Native citizens. It just doesn't want to lose environmental control or civil and criminal jurisdiction over the Indians. During spoken arguments, justices questioned the state's lawyers about their concerns and about the possible effects of letting the decision stand. Yes, there will be turmoil, said Miller. He believes the Supreme Court should not consider the effects on real life. The court is supposed to decide the case based only on the law, he said. He talked about the important 1954 court case that ended racial separation in U.S. public schools. That decision led to riots, violence, and even murders in the American South. Should the Supreme Court then, knowing what would happen, not have made that ruling? Miller asked. I'm Susan Shand.
During 2018, we reported on many inventions and new technologies aimed at making machines smarter. We also covered stories on how some technologies threaten user privacy. There was a lot of news related to artificial intelligence, or AI, and machine learning. Among the stories were two dealing with direct competitions between humans and machines. In one competition, machines that used AI performed better than human beings in a high-level reading test. Two natural language processing tools beat human results in the experiment. One of the tools was built by the American technology company Microsoft. The other was created by Chinese online seller Alibaba Group. In another competition, a computer took on humans in live public debates. The event demonstrated how AI-powered computers are increasingly being developed to think and sound like humans. The organizer of the debates, U.S. technology company IBM, announced split results. It said a majority of those watching said they felt the machine had done more to improve their knowledge of the subject. But the human got more praise for communicating her ideas. This year, we also explored the many ways AI and machine learning are now being used. For example, some U.S. judges use machine learning systems to help them decide when and for how long criminals should be jailed. The system uses computers to examine data from thousands of court cases. The computer then predicts whether a defendant will commit a new crime or fail to return to court. One fast-growing area of AI is facial recognition, which is increasingly being used for security purposes. Recently, Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson Airport became the first in the U.S. to permit passengers to use facial recognition technology to get on flights. A Chinese company showed off an AI system it developed to recognize individuals by body shape and walking movements. The system is already being used by Chinese police in Beijing and Shanghai. In addition, machine learning was used during 2018 to predict results of the World Cup soccer competition. The technology also created artwork that sold for a large amount of money. And it is being used to help farmers save time and money while reducing environment-harming chemicals. Other technology systems are being used to follow farm animals and wildlife to collect information on their activities. Facebook received intense criticism this year. The company's chief, Mark Zuckerberg, was asked to testify before the U.S. Congress about a major leak of private user information. Zuckerberg admitted the company made mistakes that led to private data being shared with a British research company. Lawmakers demanded that the social media service take steps to protect user privacy and proposed legislation to prevent further incidents. Google also faced questions about its privacy policies after an investigation by the Associated Press. AP found that Google was continuing to collect location information on users even when users had changed their privacy settings. Google said users can stop the collection of all location markers at any time by turning off a specific privacy setting. But independent researchers told AP that setting was not clearly identified by Google as being connected to location information. After several accidents involving self-driving test vehicles, we examined ethical questions about the technology. An expert on the subject, Nicholas Evans, told VOA that he is studying ways to get driverless vehicles to make ethical decisions. In many driving situations, vehicles will be expected to quickly consider levels of risk before deciding how to act. A new study found that some driver assistance systems fail to perform some actions in tests. The study was carried out by the American Automobile Association of America. Part of the study found that about 40% of people questioned believed that driver assist systems could drive a car by themselves. The organization warned of the dangers of such misinformation. In Sweden, a new technology was developed to create the world's first operating electrified road. The system is designed to charge an electric vehicle's battery as it travels. And in Germany, Officials celebrated the launch of the world's first operating hydrogen-powered trains. The new train model is part of efforts in Europe and other places to move away from polluting diesel trains. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning English. I'm Steve Ember. Last week, we talked about slavery in new American states and whether Congress could set the conditions for statehood. The Missouri Compromise in 1820 settled the issue for a short time. The compromise said that Missouri could enter the Union as a slave state, and Maine could enter as a free state. By approving these two states at the same time, Congress kept a balance of power in the Senate between slave and free states. But the compromise also said no more states in the Northern Louisiana Territory could be admitted as slave states. As a result, slavery could not enter the new areas of the United States. Some people did not like the compromise. They said it limited the ability of slave owners to settle in the country's western territory. Others said the Constitution did not permit Congress to say that new states had to be slave or free. Even President Monroe did not believe the government had the power to make such decisions. Yet he approved the compromise. He was trying, he said, to avoid a civil war. Monroe's decision to approve the compromise did not hurt his election chances in 1820. There was, at this time, really only one party, the Republican Party, and he was its leader. The opposition Federalist Party was dead. It was no longer an election threat. So Monroe was the only presidential candidate in the election of 1820. He received the vote of every elector except for one. William Plummer of New Hampshire voted for John Quincy Adams. He explained later that George Washington had been the only president to get all the electoral votes. Plummer said he did not want anyone to share this honor given to Washington. Monroe's first 4 years as president had been successful. He had increased the size of the United States. Florida was now part of the country, and the problem of slavery had been temporarily settled. There had been economic problems, some of the worst in the nation's history, but the situation was getting better. And the nation was growing. As it grew, new problems developed between its different sections. There were really three separate areas with very different interests. The northeastern states had become the industrial center of the nation. The southern states were agricultural, with large farms that produced cotton, rice, and tobacco. Much of the work on these farms was done by slave labor. The western states were areas of small farms where grain was produced with free labor. It was a place where the land did not cost much and where people could make a new start and build a new life. This division of the nation into different sections with opposing interests ended the one-party system of Monroe's administration. The industrial Northeast wanted high taxes on imported products to protect its industry from foreign competition. This part of the country also believed the national government should pay for roads and waterways to get their products to markets. The South did not agree to high import taxes. These taxes raised the prices on all goods, and import taxes on foreign goods might cause foreign nations to raise import taxes on Southern cotton and tobacco. The South also opposed spending federal money for roads and canals. The mountains through parts of the Southern Atlantic states would make road building difficult and canals impossible. The Western states supported government aid in building roads and canals. The Ohio and Mississippi rivers were the only inexpensive transportation systems for moving their products to markets. The Westerners also supported high taxes on imports because they believed such taxes would raise the prices of their agricultural products. The separate interests of these different sections produced an exciting campaign in the next presidential election. Each section had at least one candidate. Several had more than one. The campaign began almost as soon as Monroe was elected for the second time. At one time, as many as 16 men thought of themselves as presidential possibilities. By 1822, the number had been reduced to 6 men. John Quincy Adams was the only Northern candidate. He was an extremely able man. He was at the time Secretary of State, and there were few jobs in government he could not do and do well. But many people found him cold and questioning. His father was John Adams, the second president of the United States. The West had two candidates. One was Henry Clay of Kentucky, popularly known as Harry of the West. He was a great lawyer, congressman, Speaker of the House, and senator. The other was Andrew Jackson, known as Old Hickory, the hero of the Battle of New Orleans during the War of 1812. Jackson knew little about government. He was a fighter, a man of the people. In the election of 1824, Jackson got the most electoral votes, 99. But he needed 130 to win a majority. The Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, was second. Treasury Secretary William Crawford was third, and Henry Clay of Kentucky was fourth. Because none of the candidates got a majority of the votes, the decision went to the House of Representatives. The House voted on only the three top candidates for president. The most powerful man in Congress, Henry Clay, was not, therefore, a candidate. But Clay's support would be the greatest help any of the candidates could receive. All three wanted his support. Treasury Secretary Crawford had suffered a serious illness before the election, and his health was bad. Clay felt he could not support him for that reason. This left Adams and Jackson. Clay did not agree with all of Adams' policies, but he did believe Adams had the education and ability to be president. Clay did not like Jackson, the hero of New Orleans. He knew Jackson was poorly educated and easy to anger. Clay did not think Jackson would be a good president. So Clay decided to support Adams for president. He said nothing about this for a time. Several of Clay's friends visited Adams. They told him that Clay's supporters in the West would be pleased if Adams, as president, named Clay as Secretary of State. Adams told them that if the votes of the West elected him president, he would put a Westerner in his cabinet, but he would not promise that the Westerner would be Clay or that the cabinet job would be Secretary of State. Clay had still not said publicly which candidate he supported. But late in January, a Philadelphia newspaper published an unsigned letter. The letter charged that Clay and Adams had made a secret agreement. Clay, the letter said, would give his support to Adams. In exchange, Adams would name Clay as his Secretary of State. Clay was furious. He not only denied the charge, but offered to fight a duel with the letter writer. But whoever wrote the letter to the newspaper refused to say anything. Clay was sure Jackson's supporters were responsible. Snow was falling in Washington on the morning of February 9th, the day that Congress would elect the president. At noon, members of Congress walked into the House of Representatives. Each state had one vote for president. Adams was sure he would get the votes of 12 states. Crawford had the votes of 4, and Jackson, 7. New York was the question. 17 of the New York congressmen were for Adams, and 17 were against him. Adams needed just one of these votes to get the vote of New York and become president. One of those New Yorkers opposed to Adams was a rich old man who represented the Albany area, Stephen Van Rensselaer. Although Van Rensselaer had supported Crawford or Jackson, he really was not sure now whom to support. When the New York congressman voted, Van Rensselaer was still not certain. He put his head down on his desk and asked God to help him make the right choice. After this short prayer, he opened his eyes and saw on the floor at his feet a piece of paper with Adams' name on it. Van Rensselaer picked it up and put it in the ballot box as his vote. This gave Adams the vote of the state of New York and made him the next president of the United States. 2 days later, Adams told President Monroe that he had decided to offer the job of Secretary of State to Clay. He said he was doing so because of the Western support he had received. Clay accepted the offer. Now Jackson was sure that Clay had sold his vote to Adams for the top cabinet job. He wrote to a friend, "Was there ever before such barefaced corruption? What is this trade of vote for office, if not bribery?" Jackson, himself a senator, showed his feelings when the Senate was asked to approve Clay as Secretary of State. He voted no, and 13 other senators joined him against the nomination. But they were too few to prevent Clay from getting the job. With Clay as his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams began his first term as president.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.